This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytech, brings you Blowing Bubbles. Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world. How are people living their bubble lives? Working from home, keeping kids entertained, and staying connected and getting exercise. And how are these things presenting us with the opportunities to find new ways of living? Every weekday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann, Shane Gallagher and Mara Karatai reach out from their bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world. Broadcast on Otago Access Radio 105.4 FM and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz and sustainablelens.org, bringing connection, joy, kindness and peace in the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles by Sustainable Lens, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I'm Samuel Mann. I'm at the University of Toronto today with Summer Sabi. She is a postdoc and an incoming faculty member at the University of Toronto. It's more complicated than that.
It's 75% faculty affiliation at the Institute of Communication, Culture, Information and Technology. That's down in the Mississauga U of T campus, and 25% at the Daniels Faculty of Architecture, Landscape and Design.
That sounds like a fun split.
It does, and it perfectly matches my training, so I'm very happy about that.
Let's start with you. Where did you grow up?
I was born in Iraq, lived there for 6 years. My family and I then moved to Libya, then to UAE, and then at the age of 17, my family and I immigrated to the Greater Toronto Area, the GTA.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
My parents are architects, and I've always had artistic inclinations ever since I was a child, so I always assumed it was going to be something related to art and architecture, but definitely with some teaching in it. I've loved teaching from a young age. My mom is a professor, so yeah, something that had to do with design, architecture, and teaching.
How did the computing sneak in?
That was such a funny story. So we were in UAE when I was applying for universities and colleges, and you know, we said architecture, let's apply for architecture and like 12 other programs. And when I got the U of T acceptance, and I got other offers of admission, I just didn't know which one to accept. So, you know, they said U of T is the number one school in Canada, so we chose that. It turns out they had just discontinued their specialist undergraduate program. For those of you outside Canada and the U.S., a specialist is like a full program, a major is half a program, a minor is like one-third. So yeah, you could no longer study architecture on its own at the undergraduate level. And my academic advisor, she told me by email, you know, that was back in 2006, 2007, you know what, why don't you do your other major in fine arts or urban planning? Somehow, when I was looking at the U of T courses, my heart just kept bringing me to computer science courses, like web programming, software engineering, even though I had no programming experience or exposure at that point in my life. So yeah, I brought that option to her. She was shocked, but she went with it. And yeah, that's how I ended up doing that combination of majors.
And it's obviously working for you because you've carried on doing it.
Yes, architecture and computer science are quite a nice combination, because I don't know how much, when you think about architecture, I don't know if you think about computing as well, but it's a field that uses a lot of software tools. A lot of advancements in computing, you will see them reflected in the architecture field. So there's just such a nice synergy when you're in architecture and you bring that CS lens. And then for computer science, you don't see a lot of research happening on buildings and architecture. So for me, it was quite beneficial in terms of finding research opportunities, job opportunities, and I'm happy to still have my foot in both fields.
So we're talking on a radio show and podcast with sustainable in the name.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean to you?
for me, sustainable immediately goes to social sustainability in my mind. We moved a lot as a family, and then when you come from a country that was torn by war, you always, I don't know, the way I see life, I see it as relationships. I see it as people who are able to endure with each other. And I see it as difference. I did my PhD in New York City. It was a fairly new campus. And there were just a lot of strangers put in one place on this island. And for me, sustainability at all is about how do we coexist together and how do we imagine and build a future together. Obviously, the environmental angle is crucial. And I was like maybe 9 or 10 when I heard the word sustainability for the first time, because my mom did her PhD on that as an architect. Yet, I always think about it as societies coexisting together, building together. And that's what it means to me.
Coming from a war-torn country, does it give an edge to that kind of thinking? Is it, you can see the consequences of not working?
Yes. It's on multiple levels. So when something is not working, there is both beauty in that and there's devastation. So I was 10 years old. No, 10 days old when a war broke out in Iraq. And when you are raised, you know, you're always told stories of, oh, when you were born, it was so hard to raise you. When you were born, you know, things were not available. And then there was the 2003 war, which I was older, you know, and I remember it really well, even though we were outside Iraq at that point. But like, you're seeing a country where just things are going downhill in many aspects of life. And at the same time, you see other countries where you're able to think about the future. You're able to plan for the future, especially like in terms of environmental sustainability. Like if Iraq had a green cover, 15, 20 years ago, it no longer has it. So what are even the prospects of environmental sustainability that you could think about in a place like that? At the same time, people are so resilient and powerful, and you know, things break and adversaries happen and they get back up. They still have, you know, they still study and get married and have kids and plan for the future. And you're like, amazing, how is this virus of life surviving? So yeah, that's what I mean, like coming from a country like that, you're both kind of daunted by, you know, things could always break down. And I talk about unmaking in my research, but then you also have this excitement and this passion for life that somehow it will continue to happen.
So what did you do your PhD on?
My PhD was in a field called information science. It's a fairly new field, so I'm talking 15 to 20 years, and each institution defines it differently. So where I did it at Cornell, they define InfoSci as studying computing in its social context. So for me, I was studying not computing specifically, but design more broadly. Because for me, the word design, it can encompass, you know, building computational tools, but it can also encompass prototyping, physical models, architecture. And yeah, so I was studying how design as a socio-material practice can help communities in urban contexts reimagine or reconfigure the environments they share in more equitable ways.
In New York?
In New York City, yes.
So what does a social material complex look like?
Right. So there are two components to the term. There's social and there's material. So material, it's referring to the artifacts that are going to come out of a design process. And that might be a sketch model, it might be a rendering, maybe it's a digital model that goes in a VR environment, or maybe it's a social studies unit for middle school. yeah, material is very broad. And to me, it's these artifacts that you can name and you can see and you can use. Socio is about us coming together to perform that design process. So all of these artifacts that I have mentioned, they were not generated by me, say, as a designer or a researcher sitting in my, you know, in my bubble, in my cubicle, making them. It was about spending so much time with community members. You know, maybe it's a school teacher or it's the art gallery close to campus, and together shaping those artifacts. Or maybe it's community members like youth or older adults who are all gathered in one space. Maybe it's the maker space or the fabrication lab, and we're making these together. We're learning from each other as we make them. We're discussing them, iterating on them, and that's what makes it social.
And you're getting people to, or participating in, making like big maps and physical things?
Maps, building proposals, like building designs, sketch models, study units, lesson plans. Yeah. And then the usual, my research area is human computer interaction, HCI. So that also involves like computational prototypes and, you know, like interfaces and web tools.
Ooh. Let's take the first of your music choices. Let's have Ma Zain.
Yes.
Holding Hand.
Yeah.
Why this one?
I used to listen to this years and years ago before I even did my PhD, and it's about how do we find rapport across differences. And I never knew that at some point in the future, which is when I did my PhD, that I will be studying difference and rapport in my own research. So I feel everything that I used to hear in that song and why I loved it so much. It helped me survive my PhD and it helped me do the research. So that's why I love it.
I hear the flowers kind of crying loud, the breeze is sounding sad. Oh no, tell me, when did we become so cold and empty inside? Lost away a long time ago, did we really turn that blind? We don't see that we keep hurting each other, no. All we do is just fight. Now we share the same bright sun, same round. Why don't we share the same love? Tell me why not? Life is shorter than most I thought. Hold my hand, there are many ways to do it right. Hold my hand, turn around and see what we've left behind. Hold my hand, my friend, we can save the good spirit of me and you for another chance. And let's pray for the beautiful world, the beautiful world I share with you. Children seem like they've lost their smile on their new bloody playgrounds. Oh no, how could we ignore heartbreak and crying sounds? And we're still going on like nobody really cares. And we just stop feeling all the pain we cause like it's a daily basic affair. Now we share the same bright sun, same round. Why don't we share the same love? Tell me why not? Life is shorter than most I thought. Hold my hand, there are many ways to do it right. Hold my hand, turn around and see what we've left behind. Hold my hand, my friend, we can save the good spirit of me and you for another chance. And let's pray for the beautiful world, the beautiful world I share with you. Far I might be, I'm always gonna be your neighbor. There's only one small planet where to be, so I'm always gonna be your neighbor. We cannot hide, we can't deny that we always gonna be neighbors. Your neighbor, my neighbor, we're neighbors. So hold my hand, there are many ways. we've left behind. Hold my hand, there are many ways to do it right. Hold my hand, turn around and see what we've left behind. Hold my hand, my friend, we can send the good spirit of me and you for another chance. And let's pray for the beautiful world I share with you.
I do like the opening line in that. I hear the flowers crying loud. I like that line. How's the pandemic been?
It was hard at the beginning, but it ended up being very fruitful for me. I've turned it into a positive experience, even though I know for a lot of people it was not.
Were you here?
When the pandemic started in March 2020, at least officially in North America, this is when we started to really feel it. I don't know about New Zealand or other countries. I was still in New York. That's where I was doing my PhD. And then I still remember in my mind, March 12th, 2020, someone posted on a WhatsApp group I was on that they're starting to close borders. And I freaked out. For me, the idea of having to be in a lockdown without my family just was unfathomable. So I packed up a few things. I left my studio apartment in the dorm, just got on the first flight to Toronto, and I stayed since then. It was supposed to be for only 3 weeks. That's what they were saying at the time. It has become 3 years. Yeah, so most of it I spent in Toronto, I'd say.
Did you go back and get your stuff?
Once, a year ago, March 2022. So yeah, my stuff were in storage. My friends had to go in and clear my studio. And then a year ago, I went back to retrieve them from the office, the lab, sorry.
And you've been working here at the University of Toronto?
So I was working from home. And then winter of 2021, I started teaching part-time at University of Toronto. So yeah, you could say this is where I have returned to, and then started the postdoc in May 2022. So it's mostly been U of T, yeah, to be honest.
And mostly around here, some people are still wearing masks, but that's mostly gone?
It's mostly gone. We never had a curfew. So it was never after 9 p.m. you could not leave your house. However, we've had some very strict restrictions and close downs. So for example, January of 2022, they decided that you can only buy essentials. So if you go to the supermarket, the section on houseware, like mugs and stuff, it was all taped off. So you could go, you can buy eggs and milk, but you cannot buy mugs or plates. And yeah, masks were mandatory for a long time. I believe it was around April, May 2022 when they removed all restrictions. Yeah, I was on a trip. So when I came back, I'm like, oh, no one's wearing masks for the most part. Yeah.
And teaching is all back in person?
Fall 2022 is the first semester at U of T where it's fully back online. I was teaching in the winter of 2022. Yes, that's before. And I remember March being the time, or February, where we were told, all right, you can now go back in person. Not all classes were in person. I did go back to teaching in person, but the fall 2022 was all right, we're done. We're back in person.
And despite it being semester, it's pretty quiet around here. There's lots of people still working from home?
Yeah, there's an interesting dynamic happening. So a lot of staff and faculty and researchers, when you have a meeting, it ends up being on Zoom. I wish there were more people on campus. I miss meetings in person. And students too, if they can Zoom into a class, they would hope that, they try to do it, especially if they live far. The GTA is quite sprawling. My commute is 1.5 hours each way. So yeah, some people are definitely still working from home.
Are you walking? That's a long way.
I don't walk. It's bus, subway, and then streetcar each way. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
It wasn't a closer university.
It's in a city called Mississauga. A lot of immigrants live there, so we moved there when we immigrated and just stayed there ever since.
And that's where you're teaching 75%?
That will be, yes, U of T has a campus in Mississauga.
That's handy.
It will be handy. The commute may be 20 minutes, 30 minutes. If I drive 15, 20 minutes, by bus, 30 minutes. Yeah, huge difference.
Bubble sprite of the forest of Orokanui, Dunedin's favourite goddess, Tahu Mackenzie.
Kia ora koutou, nga mihi aroha nui kia koutou koutou aloha. I hope you're all having the best day, beautiful superstars in your beloved universes. And I really hope, wherever you are, whatever's happening around, this journey that we're all on together is proving to be very rewarding, very sustaining, and illuminating for you more and more day, who you are, the triumph of nature's art, perfect, unique, and here, making things be. Thank you. Now, I know that for us all, the last several years have been very tough, and it's so important that we give ourselves and each other the love, the care, the kindness, the compassion, the time, the energy, the support that we all deserve and that we are all so good at giving. I've had a wonderful day myself. Being a public holiday, I frolicked about with my dear friend Debbie at the beautiful St. Clair Beach, and we had a wonderful lunch at the Esplanade there. And it was just such a lovely time together. And Debbie's husband, my dear friend Dr. Phil Bishop, Frogman, whose job it was to protect all the frogs in the whole planet. And unfortunately, he passed away a couple of years ago. And the time that we had together is so special. Being united by that love of the living world. And I was very lucky that Phil and Debbie brought Dr. Jane Goodall to Orokanui and introduced me to her, and I was able to do more work with her for the years. And really, everybody was brought together through that love of the living world. And so today, as much as we were speaking about all the difficulties of the human world and all of the various trials and tribulations that everybody in the human world was experiencing right now, we were constantly drawn back to the comfort and the beauty and the peace and the joy that that connection to the living world brings. And of course, we were so lucky that we were sitting right by the sea for our lunch, so we could just be constantly really enjoying the sound of the sea, the breath of the sea, the song of the sea. So beautiful. And of course, Debbie has travelled all over the world, and so it was very interesting hearing of all the different places she's been to and the different wildlife she's met and different life forms and life ways that she's connected with. And it's a really fascinating time. And something that she does like to do is organise trips for her friends in different parts of the world. And of course, now that we're all free to frolic about, she will go and visit them and they'll come visit her. And they get up to all sorts of adventures. So she'll be going to Tasmania, spending time with the Tasmanian devils in the wild, which of course is so tricky now that they're so endangered. It's the best way to be able to spend time with them in their wild habitat. And she'll see all the beautiful seahorses, the same seahorse that we have here in Aotearoa, the Hippocampus abdominalis. So she'll have a wonderful time at the aquarium there. And so much for her to look forward to. It was wonderful imagining her adventuring all these different places. And so, of course, for me, looking forward to being back at Orokanui, there's so many different perspectives that I can now bring with me to that role. We will be planting a tree for Phil on Saturday, and that's very special. And there'll be people, all sorts of people coming to the tree planting, some people from zoology, where Phil worked, and some people from all different facets of his life. So it'll be lovely to meet them and connect with them and celebrate his life by planting a full tortoise tree. And Yes, I really hope for you, whatever's happening around you, that you're having the opportunity to hear stories and share stories that are really inspiring you and uplifting you. And as much as it's so important to share our grief at all the changes that have taken place, that we remember that the living world is always there for us to support us when we need. So a huge thank you to Sam and the whole Blown Bubbles team for having me. And I'll look forward to talking again soon. Thanks so much. Ka kite.
You're listening to Blowing Bubbles. I'm talking with Summer Sabi. We're recording this on the 13th of March, which is almost exactly 3 years since it started.
Exactly.
We started the show saying it was going to be on for a few weeks, and we're still going.
Amazing.
Life's changed a lot in the last 3 years. Mm-hmm. What do you think has stuck? Or we used to ask this question of what do you think is going to stick and what will you hope will stick?
Mm-hmm.
Are we still in that process of working out what's changed and what's carrying on?
Well, the part about virtual meetings, that has stuck really hard. I would say 90% of the meetings that I have are on Zoom, even though many of them are with people who are in the GTA. I think for us academics, we were always used to having like Skype calls and Zoom calls with collaborators. Like it never felt foreign when we had to switch to, you know, that format. Maybe with classes. When the pandemic happened, I was TAing a fabrication class. And, you know, this was all about being in the lab and you're laser cutting and 3D printing and you're working with like Play-Doh and the course instructor had to get super creative about, you know, creating these kits and sending them to students. So that's another thing that has stuck, proving that certain courses and design studios can actually be taught remotely. The virtual meetings, proving that things can be done remote, even things are the most physical and tangible, they've stuck. When doing work, like when doing research, always having a contingency plan that things might suddenly be shifted to virtual. We always have to have that plan, whether we're applying for ethics approval or just doing any kind of planning for grants. The fourth thing I've seen persist is the notion of self-care, like self-driven self-care. When the pandemic started, I needed physiotherapy so badly for my shoulders, and I couldn't get it because everything was closed down for a few months here. And I remember going on YouTube. I remember buying, like, actually from the library, or buying my own clinical textbooks on muscles and nerve paths and just teaching myself how to do muscle release and, like, all kinds of stretching techniques. So this knowledge for me personally have persisted, along with other people I have known who've picked up other forms of self-care that they had to kind of teach themselves or, you know, turn into a routine during the pandemic, and it has persisted, which is a great thing.
What was the nature of the government messaging here during the pandemic? Was it positive, community, let's all get through this together? How do they frame that?
It depended on, I guess, where you lived in Canada. So I know for me in the suburbs, like Mississauga is considered a suburb, even though it's more of an edge city and we have a downtown and high rise and everything. I believe the message we perceived was stay at home, do not leave at all. I remember spending a full month in the apartment, not even seeing the elevators. So that was, I feel for us, the message we got was stay at home. Downtown, I heard from my friends who lived like downtown Toronto, things were closed down, but there was a lot more social, just a little bit more socializing, maybe because apartments are smaller, the spaces are smaller. So I can't say, I don't think there was a unified message from the government. At least that was my own perception. But I think it was all about, we're strong, we can get through this together. There was a lot of that talk, and the prime minister, you know, he was on TV every single day giving a brief, and the mayors and the stuff, with that message of, we can do this, let's stick together.
The world is seeing a lot more polarization and fake news and so on. Are you seeing that here?
In regards to what, to a topic like COVID or more generally?
And COVID and in general.
Well, I think one of the changes that have come for me with the pandemic was I stopped watching the news. There was a point where everybody was looking at the statistics and, you know, there were this many recorded cases and stuff. I think after a month of that, I realized for my own well-being, I need to just disengage altogether. So I have not been following any news about the pandemic since then. What I follow would be university instructions. So they would send us an email, say, and be like, you need to do this or don't do that or wear a mask, don't wear a mask. So I cannot speak to what is in terms of fake news and COVID. I do know, in terms of other news in general, again, I do not watch the news. As someone, there are a lot of fake news about someone like me who is a visible Muslim, who is originally from Iraq, and I think from a young age that has put a level of mistrust in me when it comes to the news. You know, if I'm being portrayed as a terrorist, and I'm not. So I also don't follow the news. I talk about it with my students and mentees, you know, because they do research on fake news, but I personally do not follow the news.
Bring me sunshine in your smile. Bring me laughter.
So you've got a new job teaching between two different schools here?
Yeah, starting July
23rd. Exciting.
It's exciting. Lots of courses to develop, a new lab to establish, and a new research agenda altogether. So yeah, it's a privilege, but also a huge responsibility.
So what are you hoping to research?
My research, it has gone through different phases in my life, but it was always driven by something I was passionate about, like something that's on my mind, it's bugging me, this is off. And at the moment, I'm thinking a lot about building renovations and retrofits. They call them deep retrofits, so I mean they are substantial changes or renovations to a building so that it can be more environmentally friendly. We have a lot of these in the GTA, a lot of buildings from the 50s and 60s and 70s that could use a lot more insulation, double pane windows. And I'm trying to, and we also have a lot of immigrants who come, I mean, they take on different paths, but a lot of them would go into the renovations pathway. And I am, on my mind, what I'm thinking about is there a way that we can approach building retrofits in an interesting way that, one, leverages participatory methods of design, making, and fabrication, so that we are collectively thinking about what, you know, how do we approach the existing building stock as a city, as a community, as people who are together heading into that future of Toronto, but do it in ways that maybe create new opportunities for immigrants, new job avenues. You know, maybe instead of thinking about renovations in a conventional way, we can think about what role does digital fabrication play here? What about new advances in material science? How do we make this available to people who are new here and maybe don't even have, like, don't have a college degree? So combining elements of construction, climate change, potentially information dashboards, because when you're in a school of information, you have to think about that. But ultimately, entrepreneurship, immigration, emancipatory entrepreneurship. That's what's on my mind these days.
I like that it's got enough information science in there.
Hopefully. Hopefully.
Is that why you're still in computer science? Because you told the story of how you got into to computing. What's kept you in computing?
It's powerful. It's impactful. So, and on multiple scales and in multiple domains. So if we think about going back to building retrofits, the way the problem is approached is through, from a technical stance, it's through energy simulations. So you have these models that architects and engineers build, you know, that would take in a building design and you play with all kinds of variables and it's going to output the energy performance. And like, if you make these changes, this is the gain that you're going to get. Well, how are these models built in the first place? Like these simulators, they rely on climate data that both comes from, you know, like instruments and satellite data, and potentially like computational models. So if you think about it, these climate change models, which a lot of it is like computer science work, it has a very strong impact because what the output of the model is impacting how these simulators operate, which impact in turn how we design. And that finally turns into a space that we're going to occupy. So computing is very powerful in that way. It's also powerful when you're working with community members. Like, I can tell you, in every project I have done with civic organizations in New York, when you introduce a computational tool, like maybe that's a word count tool that we're using for oral history transcripts, or maybe it's an interactive device that uses microcontrollers, there's a lot of excitement and a lot of new conversations emerge when you introduce that functioning thing into the conversation. So that's why I've kept the CS angle. I see it, you know, having impact on multiple skills and domains. And that's why I'm trying to, you know, hold on to that in the upcoming phase of my research.
Do you have any trouble convincing your computer science, broadly defined, colleagues that this is a viable and justified thing to be doing inside computing?
If I were hired in a CS department, my answer would have been different. So I started my PhD in computer science and I switched to information science because I felt for the kind of how I wanted to approach certain world problems, it was a bit better to do it in information science. Because in computer science, your contribution to knowledge is going to rely on you. Like, you have to build things. In information science, there's less pressure to do that because anything is information, really. The conversation you and I are having, it's information. So if I were in a CS department, I think I would have been able to make the argument why this work is important. but it would still not be seen as proper CS, as if I were, say, building climate change models.
What are you taking to Hamburg?
Well, one, I need to get my tickets. I've been trying to book them for the past week, and the website keeps failing, and even customer service were not able to help me. So what I take there is going to depend on my itinerary. Like, do I go to Switzerland and then Hamburg? Do I go to Hamburg and then go to Paris? I am not sure. I know I'm taking my laptop because, you know, even with Kai, you're still, you know, we still have work to do and talks to prepare for. I will take a light jacket. I will not take any food because I love the food in Europe. It tastes so good and it just feels cleaner. Overall, it's just going to be a very light suitcase. It's always the case when I travel to Europe. Well, my laptop would be the most important thing.
Because it won't be snowing.
To be fair, in Toronto in late April, it does not snow usually. There have been years where it did snow in April, but for the most part, I wouldn't expect it to snow in April. So I wouldn't be taking my heavy winter jacket to Hamburg for sure. And hopefully I will not need it here either.
What lessons do you think we can take from the pandemic and our response to the pandemic for those bigger sorts of questions that we face as a society, thinking of climate change, social injustice, and so on?
I feel there was a sense of public acts of care that I felt during the pandemic more than I felt before. And even now that it feels like the pandemic is behind us, like regular check-ins, people doing check-ins on each other. This wouldn't impact climate change, but from my perspective, it's good for social sustainability. And if we have stronger communities, more close-knit communities, then we can plan for change more sensibly and potentially with more impact. So that's a lesson that it's easy to forget, it's easy to drop, which is let's keep checking on each other. A lot of people still live on their own. Maybe we don't have a lockdown, but, you know, they go to their work and they come back and they're alone where they lived. So doing more check-ins. In terms of bigger lessons for the climate, there was a moment during the pandemic when air travel dropped, car travel dropped, but now it has come back much, much worse. And to me, that's a lesson worth reflecting on. Like, when you're deprived of something for a while, it doesn't mean that once it's back to normal that, like, okay, I need to make up for those 2 years of travel that I could not do, so now I'm going to travel a lot. It's ironic to say this when I'm flying in weeks. For me, I say, you know what, I need to establish and expand my network, so I have to be present in person in Hamburg. But yeah, that's a lesson we have to think about. The pandemic took away certain things which were good for the environment. Is there something that we can take away from that? Like, what about local tourism? Why does it have to be flying a lot? That's definitely something I've been conscious, you know, for me, like traveling. I have been able to, you know, like going 2 years without traveling, I was just fine. I was still able to do my job as an academic. Why can't I do more and more virtual conferences? What about journals so that I don't have to travel to conferences as much as I used to before the pandemic? So that is a lesson that I think we can take forward, that reflection. And it also comes back to war. War deprives you of certain things, and it teaches you that you can actually survive without them. So once you gain them, you have to think critically. Do I really need this, or can I do without it, or just do less of it? The last lesson I'll share, the pandemic taught me to do less things. I had like 7 projects when COVID started, and all of my work was community-based. And then all of a sudden, we can't see each other, we can't meet. I'm not even in New York. And once I sat with myself and I looked at all of these projects that were happening, I was like, do you need all of these? Can't you focus on one? And that was so empowering, because I was able to drop many things, focus on what was the most meaningful, finish my dissertation. Dropping things allowed me to focus on fewer things, so the dissertation analysis was more, it was deeper, it was more meaningful. Still got the job, right, despite dropping all of these other things. And I'm just so happy with this lesson. And it's both about the things that we do at work, but also the things that we consume. If we think hard about what's meaningful, maybe less will be more. And I think that's better for the planet anyways. Yeah, that would be the last lesson I took away.
Do you think we're ready for the next disruption, whatever it might be?
I mean, there's been many disruptions here and there. I'm someone who's optimistic at heart, and I do think we can handle what's about to come if we maintain some of those pandemic ethos, like care and we're in this together. I've noticed it feels emptier. The university is more empty, the streets are more empty, but I also feel a sense of rapport that I have experienced myself over the past 3 years that's making me optimistic about the future. So I think we can handle what...
What's the role of a positive mindset for you?
It's everything. You just cannot go about life without a positive mindset. It gives you hope, because if you don't have hope that you will make it through today, tomorrow, through the next month and years, you can't survive. You can easily just hide and hope that things will be over. I did a lot of reading on positive psychology and self-development during the pandemic. I think a lot of people did that as well, so I didn't mention it. But it truly works. Like, when you expect good things, having that more positive mindset, good things will happen, regardless of the misery that you might be living at the moment, there was a lot of that during the pandemic. Positive mindset will help get through it. And never stop dreaming. Social dreaming is something I do in my research. Some, like youth, 12, 13-year-olds, are so good at it. They have not been let down by, you know, certain failures or setbacks that, you know, we have had as adults. That's why they're so good at it, thinking beyond the existing limitations. And that's something we need to do more as a society.
So some questions to end the show, and not very much time, so we're going to have to really wriggle. What is the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
Finishing my PhD despite a lot of setbacks. There were so many setbacks. One of them being not being able to continue my research in person, some health issues, and, you know, finishing that with just grace and a successful outcome. Getting a job before you finish the PhD, that counts as a success. And I'm very proud of that. Now, I've learned not to link my sense of happiness or self-worth to these external accomplishments. But, you know, I would say it's something I'm proud of. I'm also proud of being able to restart my life, coming back to Toronto, because I was not meant to come back and leave New York the way I have and leave my lab and everything. So it teaches you a lot of humility when suddenly you're like in a place you have not... I have my family and everything, but it's still, I was not part of a research lab in Toronto. My own lab in New York was getting smaller and everything. So surviving that with content, with and optimism, I think that would be the other thing I'm proud of. And just a positive message to give to people, that you can survive anything if you maintain that positive attitude. And you work hard too, by the way. This was not easy, obviously.
So we are writing a book of these conversations. It's called Tomorrow's Heroes. It's our team of people doing good work. Mm-hmm. So you're on that team. What's your superpower? What got you into the mansion?
having empathy. Something I'm proud of is that people are not scared to show me their tears. I've had people cry to me, from senior colleagues to just all kinds of ages and demographics and positions. I am not scared by tears. I actually see them as a privilege. The other person is trusting me enough, and they think I will handle their tears and I will put them to ease. So that's something I'm proud of. Is this a superpower compared to AI? I don't know. Maybe you're expecting something related to computing. I'm sorry. This is related to empathy. but that's something our world needs more of. I think as educators, we're in a... It's a type of job where you need to have that empathy. And I do hope that spreading more kindness and empathy, something I can bring... Through it, I can bring more positive change to society.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
No. And I've done work in refugee camps during the active war, but I'm not an activist. I am an academic, a researcher with a genuine interest in impact. That's why in my research, I do try to incorporate educational components so that anybody who's participating in my research is walking away with something, like a new skill or a new relationship. But no, I'm not an activist. That one takes a certain type of commitment and impact and being out there, which is something I have not done. No.
So what motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
Each day it's something different. Some days when it's 5 a.m. and I woke up right when the alarm went off, and what's motivating me is that I am going to bring happiness and joy and empathy to this world, and I will change my students' lives. I will inspire them. They'll know I am there for them. So that's, yeah, the 5 a.m. when I'm up. And then there are days, obviously, when you aren't that... Yeah, just life isn't that positive. And in that case, it's more like the self-care. Like, I am motivated by, you know what? I'm going to get a quick stretch before I go to work. And that's good for my muscles. It'll keep me going despite having a desk job. And that's good enough to carry me through the day. I've done something good for myself. It's selfish, but there are days where that's the kind of motivation that you need to have. Or a really nice cup of decaf English breakfast tea with cream. I have it without caffeine. So yeah, some days that's the only motivation that's there.
What challenge are you looking forward to in the next year or so?
Getting more software engineers, philosophers, artists, and community organizations to be in the same room and talk together about, and architects too, of course, and talk about the future of our built environment in light of both climate change, but also like alienation and social disintegration.
And lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
Every day can be a good day. You just have to find the good in it. Some days, if they start on the wrong note, you can just reset them. Maybe take that warm shower at 10 a.m. and that's when you hit the reset. But every single day has something good in it. So try to look for that good. And this way, you know, day to day to day, you'll feel happier, you'll feel more content. And look to those who have less than you do, because that will give you a sense of contentment and a sense of drive to contribute to this world.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
I am unwritten, can't read my mind, I'm undefined. I'm just beginning. The pen's in my hand, ending unplanned. Staring at the blank page before you, open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate.
You've been listening to Blowing Bubbles by Sustainable Lens, brought to you by the Sustainable Lens team. We're brought to you by Otago Polytechnic Tupukenga. We're broadcast on Otago Access Radio weekday afternoons at 3 and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz. You can find us on Facebook. We had a contribution today from Tahu McKenzie. This is Natasha Bedingfield. Unwritten. Before that, we had Sophie Madeline Bring Me Sunshine. I'm Samuel Mann. I am at the University of Toronto with Dr. Summer Sabe. That was Blowing Bubbles by Sustainable Lens. We hope you enjoyed the show. Ngāti wā.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.